This is a CBC podcast.
I usually start with the wheel because the wheel is the most time consuming.
That's Armin Jerome at his woodworking shop in Oak Bank, Manitoba, where he builds traditional Red River carts.
You want a fresh mind, because if you're feeling a little lazy, or if you feel you're not up to par that day, for some reason, you can make mistakes. And I've made mistakes. I've made wheels where I go to put the wheels together, and I looked at my ruler wrong and I'm an inch short. Okay, so I try to make sure I have a fresh mind with the wheels. And it's complicated, it takes a lot of concentration. And when you get it done, it feels like an accomplishment because, I got the hardest part done. Now I can concentrate on the body. In the fur trade, they were able to use canoes to travel the water ways to haul furs and but they were stuck with just the waterways, with the rivers. And then their mid to later 1800s, when they started going into the buffalo hunts, they needed some sort of a vehicle that they could actually transport their product. And there was no roads coming here except maybe through the states. And even in the early 1800s, the northern states were still wild.
What the Métis people in the settlement needed was a cart, and it needed to be built out of what was in front of them.
There was no roads, and they needed to find a way to build a vehicle that they could build here, have all the materials here that they needed, and could maintain them and repair them. So the Red River cart was very important. It used all they needed was hardwoods. There's plenty of that in the Red River. There's ash, there's oak, there's elm.
Traditional carts were made without nails, without any metal whatsoever. And unlike that IKEA bookcase you recently assembled, Armin had to create his own construction manual based on writings and old photographs. The first writings about the Red River cart that he found in his research were written in 1801 by fur trader Alexander Henry the Younger.
In his first writings, he describes the first cart as being a sort of a cart with just a log for wheels, like the logs were cut into slabs. Round slabs, and I guess a hole drilled for the axle. So that was the very first one that they tried. And then in 1802, they started to use spokes. So his recording then and his writings was about wheels that were made with four spokes, you know, and with rims. And then in 1803, already he's describing carts being used with multiple types of spokes. So already the evolution of the Red River cart is already beginning in that early time.
The innovation behind these carts is astounding. Like I said, they didn't use metal. But also, the wheels were dish-shaped, which helped stabilize the carts on the rough prairie terrain. After 20 years of researching and building the Red River cart, Armin believes he is building an authentic Red River cart, a design he puts to the test.
Me and my wife, we build authentic Red River carts. I don't know that our carts are any different than the ones they used in the 1800s, because I've done the research, I've checked the pictures, I read the memoirs, whatever is written, and I don't think there's any difference between these ones. Maybe the wheels were slightly higher or shorter, and maybe the shafts were slightly shorter, whatever. I don't know. I had to make some adaptations, and then I've also had the opportunity of driving a cart. So driving the carts probably for thousands of miles, then you learn why this is done and why that's done. And if you're having breakdowns early, then you know that you did something wrong, and that's how things progressed.
I'm Stephanie Cram, and this is Muddied Water, 1870, Homeland of the Métis, Episode 2, The Buffalo Hunt. That is the sound of one single Red River cart. The wooden wheel glides over the axle with an odd squeak as the cart takes on a few bumps along the road. But in this episode, we're not talking about just one Red River cart. We're talking about thousands. And those carts transport us into the wide open prairie, where we see one of the most dramatic examples of how the Métis work collectively and democratically to not only survive, but thrive. In the late 1700s, the Métis started organizing massive buffalo hunts, working collectively to kill as many buffalo as possible to get their foot in the door of the local economy, trading furs, meat, and pemmican, an essential food they sold to voyageurs traveling further west.
It was a different place than it was in Ontario. You couldn't stop every 50 miles or so and have a First Nations group there to trade to pick up food and stuff, because they just didn't do that. They moved around on the prairie, unlike in Ontario where they were right along the riverbanks.
That's Fred Shore, a now-retired professor from the University of Manitoba.
So out here, you had to bring your food with you. So the long and the short of it is, the fur trade out of Red River needed some kind of food supply, and the only food that really fit the bill was pemmican.
Pemmican is a food that was popular on the plains and was typically made out of buffalo meat. To produce pemmican, one would take fresh buffalo meat and let it hang out in the sun to dry. Once all the moisture was sucked out of it, you'd grind it into a powder and then reintroduce some buffalo fat. The food was ideal for travel because it lasted a long time, and because, simply, it would take up less space than fresh food.
So the thing is, the Métis looked at the thing about the pemmican and figured it's a money-making proposition. The trick is, of course, you have to find buffalo, kill buffalo, process them. A lot of work. So the whole community, the whole Métis community would take off and go off for what's called a buffalo hunt. The thing is, you might have 1,000 Métis. You might have 3,000 Red River carts, which presents a problem in that you can't have a cart driven by one person because you don't have the people for that. What you do is you tie the nose of the oxen pulling the cart. There's a ring in his nose. You tie that to the back right or left-hand side of the cart in front. You don't want them tied in the middle because the carts will follow in a single row and they'll dig big ruts in the prairie and you'll get stuck. So you space them out. And that keeps the carts in bunches, so 20, 30 carts tied with nose to back end of cart. And one person can drive the cart in the front and one person can make sure they steer properly at the back. So that's how you run your carts. And the guys, the people that are hunting, would all be on horseback. So it's quite a large logistical nightmare. The thing about the Métis is that they are very individualistic people. They don't like to be told what to do. They like to do things their own ways.
To make it all work, required rules.
And the rules covered everything from things like no hunting on Sundays, no swearing, no stealing, nothing like that. They agreed on what they would do under command by somebody else.
In groups of around 10 people, a captain would be chosen, or a capitaine, as the Métis would call it. There could be over 1,000 Métis on a single hunt, so there were several captains chosen.
Now that captain would then sit down and talk with the other captains, and they would review the rules, and they would pick at least 10 council members, usually one council person in charge of each little part of the hunt. But these council members also would look at the rules of the hunt, and they would pass them on and agree to them, and then they would elect or choose from amongst themselves one person to be the president, the president of the hunt. So there's now a person in charge. Looks kind of loosey-goosey, you know, kind of unorganized, chaotic, but boy, does it ever work.
Everyone on the hunt was assigned roles, sometimes based on skill. There were the guards who were tasked with protecting the camp and keeping an eye out for the enemies in the distance. Then there were the scouts who would ride ahead of the rest of the group looking for any sign of buffalo in the distance.
There is a group of people in the hunt who will be keeping an eye out on the distance, watching to see if there's any signals coming in from the scouts. And what would happen, one of the riders, this is a scout, would be out there maybe 5, 6, 7 miles, 10 miles away, and he would start riding his horse in a figure eight, say, you know, about 100, 200 feet across. And he used the figure eight because, and if you've ever ridden a horse, know that if you ride them in a circle, like people, they tend to get a little dizzy and they can fall down. You don't want to fall off the horse. Then you'd stop, ride from the left to the right instead of from right to left, and that would tell them what direction the herd is going. And you'd stop again and you ride a couple more times from right to left, and that would tell them how fast. At this point, the president of the hunt will call up the guy who's in charge of the hunters, the council member, and he'll say, run your flag. The flag goes through the camp and everybody knows hunting time.
That's when the hunters, the men with the great shot, would take off and attempt to kill as many buffalo in one run.
And they'll ride up, find the herd from the signals given by the guys riding in with the grain. They'll stop close to the herd, and then they'll move on it. They'll run the herd, as it says. Don't get excited and say, oh boy, buffalo, and off you go. You know, that's not a good thing to do. Running the herd like that gets the herd all upset. And it's hard for you to sneak up on it. And it's a really serious rule that you don't run the herd until you're told to. If you do, punishments can range from having to have one of your best coats that you use for, you know, dancing and church going and stuff cut up, your saddle cut up, and so on and so forth. They'll even go as far as to flog you if you keep doing it the wrong way. That's the rules. So the people charge down, they go into the herd. It was probably a very exciting thing to do because you've got a loaded gun. You lean over the side of the horse and you shoot the first buffalo you're close to. The gun goes off. It's a muzzle loader. You don't load it with bullets. So you have to, you know, get a paper cartridge with powder in it, open that up by biting the top off it in the wind, somehow or other get it down the barrel because you want the stuff blowing all over the place while you're riding in a buffalo herd. So you're steering with your knees. Get that powder down the barrel. Get the bullet down the barrel. You usually keep them in your mouth and just spit one down. Somebody loads them, usually one of the women, that's their job. They reload the guns and send them back out.
With the rules of the hunt so well established, it didn't take much to apply them to other issues of survival. It's why the hunt is an early expression of Métis governance.
It is the government. It can be used for any purpose. Remember, the guys come together, the men and the women come together in small groups, 10 or so, and they pick a captain. Well, the reason they're coming together could be a buffalo hunt. Could be an attack by the Sioux coming down the road. It could be the Canadian government is thinking of taking over the West. Whatever reason, you come together, you decide, you pick the council, you get a president for the situation at hand, and you carry through the rules.
The Canadian government never understood the nuances of how the Métis organized themselves. The surrounding First Nations, who at times were often the enemies of the Métis, also didn't understand it. And on the surface, it probably just seemed like chaos. But in that chaos, there was purpose. There were the leaders, the captains, counselors, and president, always democratically chosen by the people. Then there were the laymen, the hunters, the scouts, and the guards.
How they could run the logistics of a buffalo hunt, you know, you're talking a lot of stuff here. How they could do that so effectively, so quietly, so almost invisibly, and yet the system worked, it really worked. And if you look at the Métis people, once Canada takes over, they adopt the representative government system, which we have as a country. They don't follow that consensus system of the hunt anymore. Today, they tend to follow a representative government system. But it's based upon that idea that you get together and talk about things. And I can tell you, annual general meetings and stuff of the MMF are fun political exercises. A lot of talking goes on, a lot of disagreeing and arguing go on. But once they agree to something, that's it.
We're a very democratic nation. Democracy was pivotal to our existence as a people.
That's David Chartrand, president of the Manitoba Métis Federation. The MMF is a provincial lobbying body and the official and democratic self-government political representation for all Métis in Manitoba. David Chartrand has been the president of the Federation since 1997. Over that time, he's won 7 elections.
We're the only Indigenous people in this country, and in fact, even non-Indigenous. If you look at it, we're the president's elected by every Métis citizen that wants to vote. We still believe in that democracy stemming back all the way down to the 1800s and on. So you look at we always being political, I think we always believe in an ideology, in a principle of equality, and in order to stand and voice a people, represent a people, you have to be chosen by the people.
That feeling that the Métis have always been democratic, have always made their own rules, can be seen in the names others gave them.
One of the things that First Nations used to call us, Katepindimisawat, and I speak fluent Soto, and what that means is the people that own themselves. See, the First Nations saw themselves owned by the state, and we were very independent, hardworking people and strong people and military-style people, and we had to be. And if you look at a quick synopsis of our history, there was racism against the First Nation against us too, because they saw us as half a people. And so they didn't see us as equal in standing to them. And so that has been part of that collectivity of discrimination against our people. And that's why I think, you know, our music, our dance, our culture is the livelihood that keeps us together. It's the glue that kept us together.
For Chartrand, the key to keeping the Métis community alive is culture.
Even though in Canada was disallowing us to meet after Riel in 1870, they didn't want us to have gatherings. They were afraid that we'd formulate again another uprising and stand up to protect our rights. So a lot of our people used to have picnics, just to have the ability for the men to talk and the women to make sure they're all in conversation together, but to make it very clear that we were going to keep ourselves alive, our identity alive. It takes just continued devotion, dedication, but always your culture is the key. Without your culture, you will not survive. You will be assimilated. There's not a question about it. If you don't know who you are, then how in the hell are you going to know where you're going or who you're going to become? So our elders always taught us, always know where you come from so you'll never forget where you're going.
Culture has many cogs to it, like a gear. Like the Red River cart wheel, it has many spokes.
Back at Armin Jerome's woodworking studio, reminders of where he's from surround him.
There's the Louis Riel, we'll say, represents the government part, the political part. So then now there was still the music of the Métis with the fiddle and an adaptation of Irish and Scottish type fiddle mixed in with the Métis' own version, their own style. The dance, which was a part of, say, the Scottish stomping and with the First Nation dance. So that was a combination of those, both of those. And the Red River cart itself helped create the Métis Nation to become what it was, and it would created industry for them. So that is a part of the culture, how the Métis were able to travel, how they were able to develop the buffalo hunt.
Today, the Red River cart provides a connection to the past, one that was often denied by Métis people who are afraid to embrace their culture.
My dad didn't really celebrate much of his Métis culture because he was part of that group that was hiding from the identity. But I remember back when I was a kid, my dad was talking about our relations and our ancestors. And my dad had told me, our cousins did this and that, and they came in a Red River cart. And he looked at me. And I kind of looked at him, and I couldn't figure out what was he looking at me like that. He wanted to get this reaction from his son, but there was no reaction there because I didn't really know what he was talking about. That sort of a thing stayed with me over the years. And then years later, when I became more involved with the Métis culture, this resurgence of the Métis, and then I started working on these Red River carts and wanting to express this part of the culture, I thought back to that day and I thought, well, this is what Dad was talking about. Now I understand. Years later, my dad has been gone for many years, but now I know what he was talking about.
The resurgence of Métis culture is part of the story of this podcast. People are standing up and speaking out. But it wasn't always that way.
We were called bootleggers. We were called everybody lived on welfare, you know.
After Manitoba joined Confederation in 1870, the Métis dealt with racism and a system of government that pushed them out of cities like Winnipeg.
It was really, really clear that they received worse housing when the city moved them.
For many, the tie to culture and community was frayed by the dispossession of land. It meant that some communities were almost forgotten.
Oostertown, never heard of that reserve. I said, you know where the Pan Am Pool is? I said, that's where Roostertown is.
Roostertown is where we head next in episode 3. This episode of Muddy Water is written and produced by Kim Kasher and me, Stephanie Cram. Janice Moeller is senior producer of audio, and Bertram Schneider is executive producer. You can subscribe to Muddied Water on your favorite podcast app or through the CBC Listen app.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.